Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. I am welcoming you here to X Squared Radio. We're happy to have you here with us today. Last week was the Questers Conference up in Canada, Alberta, Canada, up in Calgary. I have to say I'm pretty amazed. I'm pretty impressed by the group of Questers, Earth Explorers, everyone. I was greeted with great hospitality. These people are astronomers, they're archaeologists, they're geologists, and they're all alive and awake. And if you get a chance to go to the next Questers Conference in your area, and they're all over the world, I highly recommend it. Much better than any rotary, sort of a rotary of the stars, you might say. These are the shakers and movers of the paranormal world, and we really appreciate their energy and their attention, and also their intention. They really are great, hospitable people. Showed me a lot of love, and a lot of curiosity about the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. And the solar wind is back down to a mild 355 kilometers per second. And the proton count is down to a near record-setting 0.4 protons per cubic centimeter. That means there are very few particles arriving to Earth from the sun, or anywhere else for that matter. Those of you that have been watching the sun, there is a 100,000-mile-long filament on the sun. It's not a sunspot, but these filaments now, observed very nicely by the SDO, the Solar Dynamics Observatory. In fact, they released an image today that's a composite of three extreme ultraviolet wavelengths, 211 angstroms, which is the false color red, 193 angstroms, which is green, and 171 angstroms, which is blue, each tracing a different gas temperature ranging from 1 million to more than 2 million degrees Kelvin. And I got to tell you, they highlight today's sun. It has an enormous magnetic filament, a coronal hole, and a new sunspot. That's just for starters. We are able to see things on the surface of the sun and just beneath the surface of the sun. These magnetic forces at work on the surface of the sun are really giving us something much better than SOHO ever gave us. And if you were out today in the sunshine, May 23rd, I don't know if it's just me or it may be you too. If you have felt this, you might want to call in. The phone number tonight is 415-762-1161 anywhere, on planet or off planet, if you want to reach us here at X Squared Radio. It's 415-762-1161. The sun, after just a few moments, was rather painful to the skin. It wasn't like a suntan. It wasn't like just sunbathing. It was more like sun cooking. There was an extra frequency to the sun today, it seemed. And I think I'm not alone in feeling that. So if you've had that observation yourself with your solar detector known as your skin, why don't you give us a call and let us know if it's as intense on the eastern seaboard as it is elsewhere in the country. Also, looking over the next 10 days, now Heavens Above, as you know, is one of the premier satellite tracking websites on the web. That's Heavens-Above. It costs nothing to join. You can put in your coordinates, whatever city you're in, as long as you're in the free world. We tried putting in Heavens Above in Tibet, and I'm afraid to say that it's all blanked out. No satellite data over Tibet. Anyway, if you put in your local address, it will give you how many times and when exactly things like the International Space Station, the Space Shuttle, different satellites are going to pass overhead. The X-37B, which is the unit that was launched by the U.S. Air Force last month, is now being tracked. So you can see when it's going to come over your house. However, the X-37B is passing over the eastern seaboard over the next 10 days, sometimes twice in the late evening hours and early morning hours. But don't bother going out to see it. It is light wave stealthy. It is only about 1/100th as bright as the International Space Station. And perhaps that's for a reason. Maybe they don't want us seeing when it's going overhead. But I just thought you should know that it's passing overhead about twice a day over the eastern seaboard of the United States. And you can track it by going to heavensabove.com. Might be nice to keep track of. As it turns out, there's a lot to this probe. The X-37B, of course, was launched aboard the Atlas V rocket. It is a 30-foot craft, so classified that the Pentagon will not divulge its mission, nor how much it costs to build. So you, the taxpayer, have no idea what it cost. The mysterious X-37B launched successfully by the U.S. Air Force from Cape Canaveral looks like a mini space shuttle, but its mission is top secret. It is officially described as an orbital test vehicle. However, one of its potential uses appears to be to launch a surge of small satellites during periods of high international tension. This would enable America to have eyes and ears orbiting above any potential trouble spot around the world. The X-37B can stay in orbit for up to 270 days. It's about 9 months, whereas the shuttle can only last for about 16 days, mostly because the shuttle has human cargo as well. This will provide the U.S. with the ability to carry out experiments, quote-unquote, for long periods, including the testing of new laser weapon systems. This would bring accusations that the launch of the X-37B and a second vehicle planned for later this year could lead to the militarization of space, although I would maintain that that has been going on for some decades, a la Ronald Reagan. U.S. defense officials, who would not say how much the project had cost, insisted, however, that it was just an updated version of the space shuttle activities. The launch was more about testing the craft, a new generation of silica tile, and a wealth of other advances that make the shuttle look like yesterday's space technology, which it is. NASA's X-37B program began in 1999. I did say NASA's X-37B program. And it ran until September of 2004, when it was transferred to the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency before being taken over by the U.S. Air Force. It was placed on the Air Force's Rapid Deployment Program, which made it eligible for unlimited amounts of funding and the prime launch vehicle for the Air Force's newest space-based weaponry. The flight of the X-37B is being managed, not by NASA, but by the U.S. Air Force's Space Command's 3rd Space Experimental Squadron. Quote, this bird has been through all of the shake, rattle, and roll, the vibration tests, the acoustic tests that any spacecraft would go through, said Gary Payton, Under Secretary of the Air Force for Space Programs. With all the focus on the launch of the secret X-37B, another space launch by a Minotaur 4 rocket from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California received less attention. It was carrying the prototype of a new weapon that can hit any target around the world in less than an hour. The Prompt Global Strike is designed as the conventional weapon of the future. It could hit Osama bin Laden's cave, an Iranian nuclear site, or a North Korean missile with a huge conventional warhead without the need for a terrestrial launch. President Obama promised a, quote, leap into the future for NASA yesterday in a speech designed to quell a growing dispute over his cuts to manned space exploration and to persuade critics that America will eventually put astronauts on Mars. But the transfer of NASA's unmanned replacement for the space shuttle to the U.S. Air Force converted a primarily peaceful vehicle into a primarily military vehicle. Despite canceling Constellation, the $108 billion program that aimed to get astronauts to the moon by 2020 and the Red Planet by 2030, he outlined a series of stepping stone destinations where NASA will first seek a foothold in deep space using humans and robots. The use of the military budget and leadership places in grave doubt. The peaceful use of space as a means to explore and expand the possibilities of the human race. A landing on Mars will come sometime after the mid-2030s, at least 5 years after the date Constellation aimed for. But NASA will spend more time before then looking at not just where we can go, but what we're going to do when we get there. Little does the public know right now that the military has been visiting Mars and the moon for decades, with both men and equipment designed not for terrestrial security, but instead as laying a foundation for interplanetary security of the interest of the United States government. The president delivered his speech at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. He said, nobody is more committed to manned spaceflight, to human exploration of space, than me. But we have got to do it in a smart way. We can't just keep doing the same old things we've been doing and thinking that somehow that's going to get us to where we want to go. The question is, does the government for whom Obama works want to go to the same place the human race wants to go? He continues, step by step, we will push the boundaries, starting with a manned mission to land on an asteroid sometime between 2025 before venturing further into the cosmos to scout potential sites to establish fuel deposits for future missions. The primary fuel for space travel, by the way, is H3, a compound few asteroids will have in the abundance of that contained in the soil of our own moon. By the mid-2030s, he says, I believe we can send humans to orbit Mars and return them safely to Earth. And he was echoing words chosen by President Kennedy in his 1961 challenge to NASA to put a man on the moon. A landing on Mars itself will follow, and I expect to be around to see it. Interesting. The decisions on how to get humans to such destinations will not be made for another 5 years. Instead, $3.1 billion will be spent researching new rocket technologies before a specific blueprint is selected for 2015. Orion, the spacecraft that was to have carried crews to the moon by the end of the decade, will be salvaged from the Constellation plan and sent to the International Space Station to be used in the event of an emergency, reducing America's reliance on Russia's Soyuz capsule. Meanwhile, the Defense Department will receive a $1.3 trillion budget and will have priority on any launch vehicles developed by JPL, Hughes, or the other major NASA contractors. Private explorations into space are prohibited. Critics of Mr. Obama's plan, who include Neil Armstrong, the first man on the moon, dislike it for its lack of detail and definite timeline and its failure to maintain human launch capabilities in the interim. Quote, "The president has replaced one visionless plan with another," said Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama. He said that the new plan, quote, "still ends human spaceflight," and added, "There is no rocket or capsule being built through this plan that can safely carry humans to space. The president commits to building a heavy lift vehicle 5 years from now, at which point he may very well no longer be in office. It extends the International Space Station's life by 5 years, yet the United States will have no way to reach it on our own." John McBride, a retired astronaut, told workers at a rally before the visit, he says, "We need sufficient funding to dedicate to space exploration. Back in Apollo days, our space budget for NASA was 3-4% of the federal budget. Today, it's a fraction of 1%. We have been told by our leaders that we can't have it all. I say, why not? If it costs a gazillion dollars to get to Mars, we get 2 gazillion back." When he spoke 41 years ago, the world listened, hanging on every word as he uttered one of the most inspiring phrases of the 20th century. Neil Armstrong earned himself a lifetime of respect with his one giant leap for mankind, but he has for decades refrained from exploiting it, turning down opportunities in politics and avoiding controversy. Now, the space gloves are off. The first man on the moon has teamed up with the last man, Gene Cernan, to confront President Obama over his devastating plans for NASA's $108 billion Constellation program. Mr. Obama wants to scrap the Constellation, which was meant to develop new spaceships to replace the shuttle, take astronauts back to the moon, and ultimately to Mars. I felt it appropriate that we would do something interesting here. I don't know if you have ever done this before. I know we've never done it on this program. When I was very young, we were huddled around the television set. We called it a TV set in those days. And we watched those amazing words being uttered as close to live as we could get it. I thought I would just play that for you right here, just so you could hear what it sounded like originally. Here we go. It's about a minute 44 seconds. Here we go.
I'm going to step off the limb. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Columbia, Columbia, this is Houston, ALS, over.
Columbia, 9-8, over.
Roger, the EVA is progressing beautifully. They're setting up the flag now. I guess you're about the only person around that doesn't have TV coverage of the scene.
That's all right, I don't mind a bit.
They've got the flag up now, and you can see the stars and stripes on the lunar surface.
Are you getting a TV picture
now, Houston?
Neil, yes, we are getting a TV picture. You're in our field of view now.
I'd like to evaluate the various paces that a person can traveling on the lunar surface. You do have to be rather careful to keep track of where your center of mass is. Sometimes it takes about 2 or 3 paces to make sure that you've got your feet underneath you. maybe four easy phases can bring you to a fairly smooth stop, like a football player. You just have to put out to the side and cut a little bit.
There you have it, live almost, 1969, July. Neil Armstrong was the first man to walk on the moon. There are 12 sets of footprints on the moon. Quite amazing footage to behold as we watch men going to another planet, 250,000 miles away, to explore space. We'll be back in 40 seconds. Don't go away. X Squared Radio is about to return, and you will join the program.
Spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
There was an average amount of 24 earthquakes in the last 24 hours on Earth. Only one of them was over 5.0. The Earth is strangely quiet. You know, 8 days ago, there were only 10 earthquakes over 3.0 in a 24-hour period. The Earth has finally stopped ringing, but perhaps it is the calm before the storm. Also, wanted to let you know, at the beginning of this hour, lots of people have been asking, especially with the recent conferences that we've had, the new book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is available in ebook format right now. You can get it by going to rememberthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com, and you can download it and you read it, and all the photographs and drawings and everything are in color. They won't be in color in the printed version, prohibitively expensive. We want to be able to get that in print to you as inexpensively as possible. It'll be out in print in about 40 days, hopefully in time for the eSETI conference. If you haven't made plans to be in the Pacific Northwest at the eSETI conference, that's ECETI.org if you want to register. Bring a tent. Bring your binoculars, and definitely, definitely bring a camera, because if you ever even thought about seeing a UFO, here is the place to see one. Pick up a copy of the book. You get a 25% discount off of the printed version. Also, Twitter is alive and well on X Squared Radio. If you go to xsquaredradio.com, you can follow it, or type in X Squared Radio or X2 Radio and you'll find us. I add stuff pretty much every day if I have access to the internet. I now have it on my iPod, so I can, not iPhone, an iPod. I got too many phones already. And we add stuff from time to time, which kind of lets us know what's going on. By the way, the show was off start today by about 12 hundredths of a second. And that reason is because the atomic clock is slowing down. As it turns out, atomic isotopes are not decaying at the same rate that they were. We've noticed a slight difference. So if the program started 12 hundredths of a second late today, you now know why. I also want to let you know that we are proud members of the BBS Radio Network. And if you are interested in becoming a talk radio host, you think you have a story in you, you have the ability to speak unfettered for a period of time and have people listen, I encourage you to do so. I didn't start out this way. I am a recovering scientist and just ventured into the talk radio world about 5 years ago here on BBS Radio and still a member of it. All you have to do is get a hold of BBS Radio at bbsradio.com, let them know that you heard about it here, and I'll give you a bootstrap. I'll help you get started, and you can help me too, because for every one of you that we help get started, it helps us stay on the air. So we appreciate it. We are also venturing out into the broadcast waves We have started a 30-minute version of X Squared Radio, which can be heard at webtalkradio.net. This is a short, compacted version of X Squared Radio. It's designed to achieve syndication. We're going to do 36 programs and try to launch out there in the late night on broadcast radio to see if we can tell a more scientific story from a more scientific point of view. We don't do ghosts. We don't do conspiracy theories, or at least we try not to. I have been very tempted to do a story on or an interview on chemtrails, and we're still searching for a credible, really listenable witness that can bring you some factual evidence without scaring everyone indoors. And we'll bring that to you. So if you want to be part of today's program, and believe me, I could sure use your help after being gone for a week. We ran an archive of John Riley and Zero Point Research last week. There's a lot happening in the world. We're going to go a little bit more into the space exploration in this hour, and I also want to cover a couple of news stories. I know that after a demand from Representative Edward Markley of Massachusetts for a live feed of the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico to be made publicly available on the web, BP officials said they would release the feed and it will be shown on Markley's committee website. And if you want to watch that feed, you can go to globalwarming.house.gov, globalwarming.house.gov, and you can watch that feed. The release is expected this Tuesday night, so make sure to mark that down, globalwarming.house.gov, and you can watch the live goings-on at the now-defunct oil rig out in the 50 miles out in the Gulf. This may be BP's footage, but it's America's ocean, he says. Now anyone will be able to see the real-time effects the BP spill is having on our ocean, said Markley, who conducted a briefing Tuesday with independent scientists where he reiterated the call for a video feed. This footage will add analysis, or aid analysis, by independent scientists blocked by BP from coming to see the spill. I think it's interesting that our politicians are making politics out of a disaster, but nevertheless, I think his heart might be in the right place. Let's go to the phones. Scott from Florida, you're on line one. Welcome to the program. Are you there, Scott?
About the e-book.
There you
are. I did purchase a copy of the e-book, but I was on Mozilla Firefox when I did so, so I couldn't download it, and then I lost the window to download the e-book when I did that, because I had to get out of Mozilla. In fact, I uninstalled Mozilla so that I could get back on Internet Explorer, and then once I did that, I lost the window to download the book, and I was wondering if there's a technical person who you could refer me to so I could download the e-book.
Sure. Yeah. We'll put you in touch with our technical department. Why don't you go ahead and email info@x2-radio.com. We'll resend you the link, no problem. I forgot to tell people, I mean, it does say on the website, and I do forget from time to time to announce here on the radio, you can't use Mozilla Firefox to download this PDF. I don't know why. It's a weakness of Mozilla, or maybe it's a weakness of my code. You have to use Internet Explorer, and not my choice. I didn't say only Microsoft will work, but only Microsoft will work on this. So if you'll download it using Internet Explorer, you'll get it. It'll download in just a few seconds, and you'll have it for your enjoyment. So email me, info@x2-radio.com, and I'll resend you the link, Scott. What's on your mind? What's going on down there in Florida?
Well, I think it's just the usual concern with the ongoing pollution and the Gulf of Mexico and all those things that it seemed to alert me to, you know, the dwindling urgency for alternatives, just a general sense of restlessness, I would say, on my part, as well as exhaustion.
Sure, sure. Well, I know a lot of people are down there in Florida, and they've noticed that little tar balls are starting to come ashore. I guess the real devastating story is they've actually sprayed some of the spill with a coagulant that pulls the spill together and makes it heavier than water, which sinks it to the bottom. And what people don't realize is that the shellfish, the shrimp and the oyster population of that part of the Gulf of Mexico is now being threatened. From Louisiana all the way to the western coast of Florida, we're talking about the loss of fishing in that area for a decade, maybe two?
Yes.
And I
also assume a red tide will become even more prevalent as a result. I'm not a scientist in that way. But I'm assuming because we were having problems with red tide about 3 years ago, and it was to the point where I could not breathe when walking along the beach over here in Daytona Beach when we had red tide over here. It was so strong that it was suffocating to me. And, you know, some people were affected by it. But, you know, I know over on the west coast of Florida they have it very frequently. And if the red algae, you know, if the circumstances are right, then they thrive. And I'm just wondering if with all the oil and the damage that it does, that the red algae will take advantage of that and will thrive.
It's hard to say. We used to have red tides from time to time on the Pacific, where I grew up. And it is a red algae, and it puts off carbon dioxide. It robs the water of oxygen and makes it difficult for the fish. And it's usually a local phenomenon. It hugs the shoreline pretty well, lasts for maybe 2 or 3 days, and then it starves itself out. But red tides can be devastating to things like abalone, clams, shrimp, those kinds of things in the area. It doesn't really smell that good. We used to surf in it, so it's not really harmful to humans, but it does make for kind of a murky water. I don't really know how it does in the warm waters of the Gulf or off the coast of Florida, but in the chilly waters off of California, where even on a really, really warm day, the water might get up to 75 degrees, that's iceberg weather for Florida people. The ocean's a lot warmer over there. But you can't surf in Florida either, not very well anyway. So I grew up surfing because I lived on the beach, or at least I tried to live on the beach 12 blocks away. But I spent more time down there than I did at home, so I'll probably pay for it in my second century of life. But for now, I'm still enjoying the benefits of it.
I also did a kyanite grid on myself today and last night, putting kyanites over all the chakras and doing a meditation while laying on the floor with that. And I felt that was somewhat rejuvenating to be able to do that. I have so many kyanites. I have about 10 of them, but I use them over the chakras. And that was a good experience for those out there who are into stones and crystals, that it's one way to kind of clear them. Clearing the chakras as well as aligning them and balancing them to have the kyanites over the various chakra places of the body.
That's good to know. I'm not a crystal
rejuvenation.
What do you call it? A crystallologist. I'm not a student of crystals, although I have a couple of encyclopedias on them, and totally fascinating stuff. Just blows my mind that crystals, you know, we used to make radios out of them when we were kids, but they do resonate at least one frequency. They can resonate at many frequencies, and all it takes is just a tiny bit of energy, some of it just earth energy, to get them vibrating. And it is a known phenomenon that these resonations can have effects on biological systems. I've watched it happen. It's amazing.
And the benefit of kyanite and citrine both don't hold any kind of negative energy. So one can be in any kind of bad place, and then you get near those crystals, and then they won't absorb any of it. They'll in fact bring you to a more positive place. And I think before you'd mentioned that you had malachite and a rose quartz that you carried around with you, there was something about malachite I wanted to tell you. The malachite's an excellent stone for those who are interested in the mysteries of the world. It helps to reveal those mysteries, to help one study the mysteries and to gain knowledge by holding malachite, by meditating with malachite, and so on and so forth.
Well, you might
so
be able to help me out here.
With the right stone, Dr. Brooks.
You might be able to help me out here. Somebody told me that malachite was a healer's stone.
And I would say it does that too.
Interesting.
It's very intense energy. What, it comes from Bisbee, Arizona, where the copper mines are.
I know that it has some energy to it. I've actually seen, I guess what they call a wand made of it and actually mounted with another stone on the back of it. I think it was a selenite. Really interesting combination.
And selenite has a strong, there were pictures, in the National Geographic a while back of these huge sheets of selenite that made people look like dwarves down in where it was Mexico or South America somewhere where they're finding, they look humongous, the sheets of selenite. Of a dream stone, has a dream energy as well as I think it projects its own energy is in terms of connecting people to the angelic realm, connecting people to their spirit guides, as well as from what I've heard from what Melody says, selenite's good for straightening the spine, that if one has curvature of the spine, one can straighten out with selenite. Gypsum is a form of selenite, and those are good for dreaming, for putting by your bed on both sides to help one remember their dream.
Wow. I'll never retain all this. I'm writing as fast as I can write here. I know that selenite grows rather quickly, and it's pretty lightweight. It has like veins in it, much like a celery or a rhubarb, all growing in the same direction. It's a pretty rapid-growing crystal.
Yes. From my experiences, it does. I mean, if you have I've experimented with selenite logs. I've had logs as big as like a wooden log that you'd put in the fireplace. I've had some as big as that.
Oh my goodness!
Experimented with those for sleeping, and experimented with gypsum. The gypsum seem to remember the dreams real well with the gypsum. They're desert rose, gypsum, that's pretty much the same thing. They're kind of a brown-looking stone, and the desert rose looks just like the name. It looks like a rose made of sand. And those are good for the dreaming and remembering the dreams.
Wow, that's what I need to do is remember my dreams. I know I dream a lot, and I'm told that lots goes on there. Well, listen, I thoroughly appreciate the phone call, and keep us posted.
Sure.
And don't forget to email, and I'll send you that link.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Bye.
Good night. Earth Explorers, I wanted to let you know there's a lot more news, and I want to make a point of this because it's kind of current event. It may not be in the archives, but I have a feeling the effects from this are going to be around for a while. You know, state officials in Louisiana are saying they will not wait for approval to build sand barriers. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal said the state is not waiting for federal approval to build the sand barriers to protect the coastline of the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. Jindal's defiant comments Sunday came as oil pushed at least 12 miles into the heart of Louisiana's marshes. Two major Pelican rookeries are now awash in crude. Jindal made his remarks on a boat at the edge of one of the Pelican nesting grounds in a looks like Barataria Bay. He and officials from several coastal parishes say the berms would close the door on the oil spill pouring from deepwater gusher about 50 miles off the coast. You know, these gushers do happen from time to time naturally, but they're usually far out at sea, and these kinds of things dilute, you know. The solution is dilution, but when it's 50 miles off the coast, you don't have a lot of time. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is studying the environmental impacts from the emergency barrier proposal. Don't be surprised if they come out and say that the impact of the barrier is worse than the impact of the oil. The Corps didn't immediately respond to emails and telephone messages from reporters. There's a lot going on out there, too, and we'll keep you posted throughout the evening about what's going on with the spill, what's going on with reactions to the spill, and lots of people are asking the question, why are fuel prices going down with such a disaster in BP's own backyard? The yellow and green flower burst on their signage, and the continual flow of national commercials depicting BP as the champion of environmental causes, people are wondering why oil prices or why gasoline prices have not gone up. In fact, 2 weeks ago, a gallon of premium gasoline was $3.18. Today, it is $2.98. And we're at a loss. We don't know why. Normally, what would happen is the oil companies would dig in and start gouging and say that this is being very expensive to them, and so they're going to raise prices. My feeling is that maybe, a la Exxon Valdez, they don't want to draw the crosshairs to them. Maybe they, too, are feeling the economy as we are. We'll see. We'll see. We'll keep you posted on that. You know, I got to tell you, mankind has perhaps been here before. You know, the pride in technical achievements of NASA has never been higher than it was in 1969. A lot to be proud of there. We felt a sense of pride, a sense of accomplishment, a sense of miraculous accomplishment. Like we had accomplished the impossible by going to the moon. With the technology that we had in the late 60s and early 70s, it is nothing short of a miracle. Today's technology, I dare say we could do that quite easily. But before I get into that story much deeper, let's go ahead and talk to Mark from Ohio. You're on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Agnew. How are you today?
I am doing wonderful. Good to be back in the east. The northwest of Canada was absolutely stunning, looking to the west and seeing the snow on the mountains and seeing the dry, windy wheat fields of Calgary. Just an amazing planet up there. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and I wanted to tell you I certainly did feel the unusual intensity of the sun today. However, I have a few other topics that I thought you might be interested in discussing.
All right, let's go.
Have you ever heard of a researcher named Henry Kroll?
Yes, I have. It's been a while. Refresh my memory.
Well, Henry has written a whole series of books, but in one of these, he describes that he actually managed to get from a researcher in India an ancient Sanskrit writing that talked about how the ancient Vimanas were built. And I'm sure you've heard of the Vimanas, correct?
I have, and we were going to talk about that this hour. It's so apropos. Please carry on.
That's interesting. And I know you're probably familiar with the Mahabharata, which talks in great detail about how these flying crafts existed in ancient India. It also talks about the wars between these crafts. I'm sure you've heard of those stories.
Right, correct? Right. These are primarily airships. They flew on wings, and some of them even had very un-aerodynamic designs, and nevertheless they flew, and we don't really know how. But we read voluminously about their uses.
Well, Henry got a hold of an actual schematic drawing of one of these crafts, and he goes into great detail about how they were built and how they flew. And have you ever seen the picture that appears sometimes in the doctor's office that shows two snakes spiraling up a pole?
Sure, right.
Well, Henry says that is the way the propulsion system on these crafts worked. What they did is they had a center pipe that went up vertically, or at some angle, possibly, and then there were two spiraling pipes around the center pipes, and they were welded together such that you could put mercury inside these pipes, and then the pipes were rotated at a very, very fast speed. And I think that mercury weighs about 112 pounds per gallon. So Henry talks about three forces that were involved in the rotation of these pipes. And he called them the centrifugal force, the centripetal force, and the Coriolis effect. And I had to do a little research myself to just make sure I clearly understood all these different forces that are involved. And I think the centripetal force is the force which makes a body follow a curved path towards the center. And I think the Coriolis effect is the deflection of a moving object when we have a rotating frame of reference. And sometimes you can see, like, kids playing on a merry-go-round, and then they'll have a film of the ball, and it looks like it curves when they roll the ball out.
Right.
But anyway, the point of this whole thing is that when these pipes rotate, because this very heavy mercury is going through these pipes, Henry claims that what these ancient crafts did was they created a time field, and they actually affected the space-time around the craft. And according to Henry, when you affect time like that, the space-time, it also creates that anti-gravity effect. You know, kind of like when electricity flows through a wire, you create, I guess, a magnetic field. Now you have this conductor flowing through a pipe, and that creates the time field. And when you affect time, you affect gravity. So that's how you get the anti-gravity. Isn't that fascinating?
Well, it is. And another benefit of being able to warp time like that is outside the craft, it looks like it makes a left-hand turn at 10,000 miles an hour. But inside the craft, it's a matter of sitting down and having a cup of tea. It's really not the kind of turn that would slam you up against the driver's window. So that would be also an effect, that the space-time, that is to say, the field of affected gravity inside the craft would be different than the field outside the craft. It would be like a unified field in and of itself with its own forces.
So the craft is functioning in a different time frame, correct?
Than outside the craft, that's correct. You could,
yeah.
It's a little difficult to explain, but if you've ever been in an aircraft, either as a pilot or co-pilot, and you've made a high G turn, you'll see the limits of the human body pretty quickly. I can take about 3.5 Gs and I start going tunnel vision. I would not make a good fighter pilot. I'm way too big in the upper body. Most fighter pilots are about 125 pounds, have little skinny butts, and not much body mass, and they can take the G-forces. But if you could alter the time inside the craft where you're making what seems to you a nice, long, lazy turn, outside the craft, it looks like you just turned on a dime.
Yeah, that's, you know, that is just so interesting to me. I think Dr. Pete Peterson, who was interviewed by Project Camelot, also claims that he has seen those ancient diagrams, and that, and he claims he built some kind of craft for the government of some kind that operated on a similar principle. So I think that there's probably technology out there today that utilizes some of these principles. I wanted to bring up one more thing, and then I'll free up the phone line. I don't want to take up too much of your time. But another thing that Henry talks about is something called orbitally rearranged monatomic elements. Have you ever heard of those?
No, I haven't. Monatomic basically means that it's a pure, and it's not a compound. It's just a collection of atoms. It hasn't actually formed a single molecule. That would be a little bit like a solid mixture instead of an actual bonded compound. It's very difficult to achieve.
You know, you might be interested. I think David Hudson was the first person to really bring up what they now call orm atoms. And Henry claims that orm atoms are these orbitally rearranged monatomic elements. They have paired electrons that pass each other at twice the speed of light so that they actually exist in multiple space-times. And he says what you can do is you can heat up these orm elements. They exist in a white powder,
mm-hmm.
and you can heat them up with a torch, and you can actually watch the powder disappear when it is heated up. And he claims that the powder actually goes into another space-time, and then when it cools off, it comes back and is visible again, which I thought was just absolutely astonishing. But
wow.
He says that somehow these orm elements, I don't know if I can explain this or not, but I'm sure you've heard of the concept of where two particles seem to be linked together even though they're at great distances from each other?
Yeah, it's called entangled particle theory, and actually we are, there's a debate going on. We can't figure out whether there are two particles entangled with one another. We change the spin on one particle and a remote distance away, like in the aspect experiment. The other particle changes spin instantaneously, you know, immeasurably faster than the speed of light. We haven't decided whether they are two particles or actually the same particle existing in two places at once.
That is just absolutely fascinating. Henry says that something along the lines that these orm atoms, and even he says living cells have the same property in that somehow they're attached through this other dimension, and in this other dimension, time and space don't really exist. And he talks about when NASA took some of their astronauts up, they would actually scrape a little of the cells off of the inside of their mouth, and they could monitor those cells, and they would get information from those cells faster than their electronics would send back. So they could tell the state of the astronauts based on those cells. So I guess the theory is that certain particles are actually somehow connected through this other dimension. Does that sound like what you heard?
It does. You know, physics, biophysics, molecular biology, we're all kind of crossing into one another's territories right now. But I got to tell you, most PhDs are experts in very, very small areas, and they rarely cross over into other sciences. However, there are some generalists, like physicians and instructors, who are beginning to get enough cross-thought in various disciplines that they're now publishing books. A good example would be Dr. Bruce Lipton's The Biology of Belief. Excellent book. He was a med school instructor in the Caribbean, and made some pretty startling breakthroughs while he was working on the Human Genome Project. He experimented with removing the nucleus of cells to see if they could continue to function, you know, respirate, protect themselves from toxins and so forth. Of course, they couldn't reproduce because they didn't have the genetic material with which to reproduce, but they could run. They could function. And it was discovered in that exercise that the nucleus was not the brain of the cell. It didn't tell the cell what to do. The cell had another way of storing its information and running its program, sort of like ROM, you know, like a hard drive. And what they discovered from a biochemical standpoint, a molecular biological standpoint, is that it was actually the cell wall that was working like a liquid crystal, and it was storing information like the gates and channels of a printed circuit. And that's how it was running. That's how it was functioning. So the idea that the program could be, shall we say, overwritten by the environment rather than the genetic information in the nucleus of the cell was the real breakthrough.
Well, you know, there's so much information out there. It's just absolutely astounding. I would recommend, I don't know what your schedule is like for people to interview, but Henry would be great if you could get him on the list. And I'm going to keep studying his book and try to get through it. I love when I find these kinds of books because it's just a total joy to try to wrap your mind around these concepts. And I appreciate being on your show, Dr. Agnew, and you have a good evening, and I'll talk to you later.
I appreciate you, Mark. Thanks. Have a great week up there in Ohio.
Bye-bye.
Good night. So, in fact, that is exactly what we were going to talk about tonight. You know, mankind in 1969 had once again reached into space for peaceful reasons. The only excursions into space known before this time were in stories about the Vimanas, as Mark was alluding to. And these are the world's oldest texts, the Vedic texts, that describe air and space traveling ships. As in modern times, the race to space, however, in those days, was also driven by the desire for more advanced weapons systems. Today, the only trace of these ancient flying machines of India are found in the Vedic texts themselves and are thought to be only stories, although there are replicas out there. In the Cairo Museum, for instance, there is a model of an airplane. It was rediscovered by Dr. Khalil Messiah, who studied models made by ancients. The discovery was considered so important by the Egyptian government that a special committee of leading scientists was established just to study the object. And I've got to tell you, we may post this picture on the website at xsquaredradio.com. Earth explorers, it only could be an airplane. It isn't a bird. It has a straight up and down tail. It has wings. Looks like a supercritical wing above a fuselage. And to elucidate the reasons for the decision of the committee, almost unprecedented in the field of archaeology, we'll consider some aspects of the model. The model has the exact proportions of a very advanced form of pusher glider that is still having some bugs ironed out. This type of glider will stay in the air almost by itself. Even a very small engine will keep it going at low speeds, as low as 45 miles an hour. That's the stall speed of a Cessna, which is very similar in this design. It can also carry an enormous payload. This ability is dependent on the curious shape of the wings and their proportions, the tipping of the wings downward. A reversahedral wing, as it's called, is the feature behind this capability. A similar type of curving wings are implemented on the Concorde airplane, giving the plane a maximum lift without detracting from its speed. I gotta tell you, birds aren't made this way. This is not a bird's wing. It doesn't function that way. Birds have a different design of wing. Birds have a wing that obeys a principle called Bernoulli's principle. It's curved in the bottom, flat on the top, creating a very fast airflow across the top and very slow airflow along the bottom, which creates lower pressure on the top of the plane. So the plane is literally sucked up into the air, pushed up into the air by wind underneath it. The faster the plane goes, the more lift it has. Of course, you can use the tail to aim the plane and keep it from continuously climbing into the limits of the atmosphere. And the other, it's pretty well known, a Central American airplane. This is a gold plane. It's about the size of an earring, I suppose. But it has a delta wing, and it has a fuselage, not only elevators, but also a rudder, also not on birds. And it has a cockpit. Now, admittedly, it's small, and it's 1,000 years old, but it was either lost by a time traveler from our day, as it looks a lot like an F-4 Phantom, or they saw somebody or were able to fly in those times. My question to you is, what do you think? And I would very much like to have your opinion on this. And we will await your phone call at 415-762-1161. We'll be back after a short musical interlude. Take a break, take a drink. We'll see you in about 4 minutes. Don't go away. X Squared Radio is about to return.